We turn to Numbers, and I think you'll be aware that we've got, I've got the responsibility of thinking on the first four chapters all in one go. And I hope you have the outline, which on the other side has a little diagram, which I will from time to time refer to. Now, I wonder what you felt when you heard Numbers 1 or parts of it, or parts of chapter 2 or parts of chapter 4 read out. There are four censuses, four countings of people, and there's lots of details about the Israelites camping and about the order in which they were to move, and particularly about the Levites being responsible for all sorts of different parts of the tabernacle. And, well, at first sight you may think, this doesn't look terribly promising material for us. But you know something, nothing is in the Bible by accident. And therefore, with the help of the Holy Spirit, we believe that we can hear, see things that have been recorded and preserved for our instruction. In fact, I think these four chapters tell us four fundamental things about God that should encourage us and challenge us, because we're his people today. So what's the first thing? It's the purpose of God. God has a purpose. Can you imagine being on a desert island? Now, being on a desert island might seem quite a lot of fun if you've been working really hard, and the idea of, you know, being in lots of sand and sea and all that sounds rather wonderful. But imagine you're on the desert island with nothing to do. There was nowhere to go. Nobody was expecting you for anything. Nobody had given you any task. You got up in the morning, and there was nothing. Now, that might be rather nice for a day or two, or even a week or two, but it would do your head in if you lived without a purpose. But you know something? All around us are people living without purpose. I mean, that is, they got little purposes, but nothing really significant to live for. They're going to work, and that's not a bad thing to go and do. They've got families, and that's not a bad thing. But they do not understand why they're here on this globe. So actually, the purpose of God is phenomenally significant for us if we're to make sense of what we're here for. And this book is about God's purpose. Now, the first word in the book of Numbers is not translated in English translations. We would put it as the word "and." In the Hebrew, it's just one little mark. But it's usually not translated at the beginning of a book. But it is a connecting word. And right away, in the Hebrew, that tells you this came from somewhere. It's connected. It's part of a bigger story. Well, just look in verse 1. Verse 1 talks about Moses. Well, we've heard about him before. We've been reading through Exodus and Leviticus. We'll know all about Moses. And the tent of meeting. Well, if you remember, we spent quite a lot of time thinking about the tent of meeting in Leviticus and Exodus. And then Sinai. Well, we've heard of Mount Sinai, haven't we? In Exodus and Leviticus also. And the Israelites coming out of Egypt. Well, we've read all about that in Exodus. Do you see that Numbers is connected on to what has happened before? And each of the previous books start with that little same letter, "and." So Leviticus begins with "and," because Leviticus is connected to Exodus, and Exodus begins with the word "and," because Exodus is connected to Genesis. And there's no "and" at the beginning of Genesis. So you see, they're like carriages in a train that take us back to Genesis. But like a train, it's going somewhere. It's not just sitting there. So Numbers, from the beginning, is written anticipating something. It has purpose. It isn't a static story. They begin in Mount Sinai in verse 1. They have escaped from Egypt, but they haven't escaped from Egypt to stay at Mount Sinai. They're going to move on. In fact, the whole book of Numbers is really a journey. You see, there are people who have been saved by God. They were slaves in Egypt, and they've been delivered. But they haven't yet fully entered into what God has promised them. Because God has promised them a place of their own. So they are between being saved and arriving home. And you know something? That's just where we are as Christians. God has saved us through the cross of Christ, through faith in Jesus alone. We're saved people. But you know something? Well, we haven't yet arrived home. We're not yet in a sinless world. We're not yet people totally transformed, as one day we will be, into the likeness of Jesus. We're not yet with the Lord. We're on a journey, and so were they. And that's why we've called this whole series, or AD has, Life Between the Times. That's a very good title. So let's go back to the beginning of this particular train journey, and it starts in Genesis. And in Genesis 12, God promised Abraham a land and descendants and blessing. And you could say that the whole of the rest of the Bible is the unlocking and unpacking of those promises. And it's those promises that are the engine driving this train along. You see, if you go into the book of Exodus, you find right at the beginning that there's a sense of purpose, of destination. In Exodus 3, when God first speaks to Moses, he tells them this, that he'd heard the distress of the Israelites. I've come down to rescue them from the hands of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Well, do you see that God's plan wasn't just to rescue them out of something, but to take them somewhere better? And that is the agenda behind the whole book of Exodus. God is taking them out of Egypt, but he's taking them towards the promised land. In Leviticus, there were references, we might not even have noticed them, but to the future. For example, Leviticus 14:34, when you enter the land of Canaan, which I am giving you as your possession. Leviticus 25:2, when you enter the land I'm going to give you. There is this sense that we're on a journey, we're going somewhere. And it's that same sense of purpose that fills these initial chapters in the book of Numbers. And there are three words that imply this sense of purpose. The first is the word army. Well, look in chapter 1. Moses is commanded by the Lord to take a census, verse 2, of the whole Israelite community, listing every man one by one. What's the purpose? Well, in verse 3, you are to number by their divisions all the men of Israel, 20 years or more, who were able to serve in the army. And we didn't go on to read this, but from verse 20, you get the outcome of all the census, which is described in terms of each tribe. And there is a refrain. All the men, for example, verse 20, 20 years or old or more, who were able to serve in the army, were listed by name one by one. And that phrase, able to serve in the army, ESV, go to war, comes in verse 20 and verse 22 and verse 24 and verse 26 and verse 28 and verse 30 and verse 32 and verse 34 and verse 36 and verse 38 and verse 40 and verse 42. And verse 45, 13 times. You see, they're getting ready. God is preparing them for conquest. God is preparing them for something he has in the future. They haven't arrived yet, but God is preparing them for the conquest of the promised land. The second key phrase is the word set out. In chapter 2, the Israelites are told how they were to set up camp. And they were set up in groups of three tribes. If you go to the back of your sheet, we'll come back to this. But the tribes were clustered in threes. Okay, so I put a little one by Issachar, Judah, and Zebulun. Then two is Gad, Reuben, and Simeon. And three is Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh. And four is Asher, Dan, and Naphtali. And the little letters, the letters are to do with the fact that not only are they positioned there for camping, but they are commanded to march out, to set out in a particular order. So verse 9 says the camp of Judah will set out first. And verse 16 says the camp of Reuben will set out second. Verse 24 says the camp of Ephraim will set out third, and finally the camp of Dan will set out last. And verse 34, just look at the end of chapter 2. So the Israelites did everything the Lord commanded. That is the way they encamped under their standards. And that is the way they set out. They're going on a journey. They're leaving. They're going somewhere. So the whole book is sort of, the whole dynamic of Numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4 is about going on a journey. It's like living in a port. Margie and I used to live in Southampton, and down at the port there were big boats, and there was a constant departing. And that's what they're here doing. They're being made ready for departure. And the third word is rather similar. It's the word carry. And the last two chapters that we're looking at, chapters 3 and 4, are full of the details of how the Levites were set apart from God, devoted to look after the tabernacle. And they're given special responsibilities. Now, their responsibilities are described in that word, to carry. They looked after and carried. So in chapter 1, verse 50, which we did read, it says there that they are to carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings. Whenever the tabernacle is to move, the Levites are to take it down, and whenever the tabernacle is to be set up, the Levites shall do it. They were the carriers. And chapter 4 gives all the details of how the three different groupings, the three different clans of the Levites were given responsibilities for different parts of the tabernacle. So it was a huge operation to carry this structure with them. And 13 times in the chapter 4, you get the word carry, carry, carry. Now, why do you want to carry? Well, because they were going somewhere. It's like your children asking, why are you packing? Well, we're going on holiday. Didn't you realize? We're going somewhere. And there's that whole sense, you see, of going somewhere. There's a sense of purpose. This whole book is rooted in this sense that God is taking them somewhere. Do you know that God, if you're a believer, God's taking you somewhere? God is taking you somewhere. You haven't yet arrived. We still live in a broken world. We still live in a world where aeroplanes disappear or crash, and where people are killed, and where all sorts of diseases spread, and where all sorts of things go wrong in this world. We're not yet home, but God has promised us a destination. And it's really important that we understand that we've got something bigger to live for. We're not just living for work. We're not just living to go on holiday. We're not just living for the retirement house. We're living for arriving where God needs us to be. So in Colossians 3, and we've sung songs that reflect this, Colossians 3 says, set your heart on things above. He could have said things ahead, things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on earthly things. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will also appear with him in glory. Set your heart on what is ahead. I talked to dear old James this morning. You know what he wanted to talk about? He wanted to talk about heaven. Isn't that a great thing to talk about? And how often do Christians talk about heaven? I think we need to set our hearts and set our minds on things ahead. And we're called together on a journey. In Hinduism, there is a view that history is just a circle, all the time. You live, and then you die, and then you're reincarnated, and depending on your karma, depending on how you did last time, you come back appropriately. You know, you might come back as a low caste person, a sweeper of the road, you didn't do too well. Or you might come back as a beetle, and that means you did really badly. And next time, after you die, depending on how you performed, you will come back again, and you'll come back again, and you'll come back again, and you'll come back again. You come back again. It's a dreadful cycle. Because there's no escape from the cycle. But you see, the Bible is linear. You're going somewhere. People are either going to glory or to hell. We're going somewhere. So there is a sense of purpose. And we need to live in the light of that purpose. And we need to teach our children that we have a bigger purpose than doing well at school or, you know, getting married. We have a bigger purpose, which is to know the Lord and go on that journey. Secondly, the presence of God. Now, I talked about how often words have appeared, carry and army and so on. But the word that appears easily the most is the word tent of meeting or tabernacle or sanctuary. There are three words, all describing the same thing. And in these first four chapters, they come 55 times. 55 times. They dominate, especially in chapters 3 and 4. Now, if you look at the end of Exodus, you don't have to turn there, but if you went to Exodus 40, you would find that the tabernacle was first in operation on the first day of the first month. And Numbers begins, verse 1, on the first day of the second month. So the tent of meeting had actually only been in existence, brought together and finally completed a month before. And when that took place, Exodus 40 describes how the glory of God came down upon the tabernacle and in such a way that Moses couldn't even enter it. You see, God was there. You see, what is the tent of meeting telling us? God is present. God is present. So let's just think about that. What does that mean? Well, the first thing it means is that God is central. God is never a kind of backseat passenger. See, the tent of meeting was not placed sort of somewhere, you know, a few miles away from the Israelites. Look on the diagram on the back. Where is the tent of meeting? Right in the center. And it was always in the center. Because you see, this, what I put there, is reflecting in a diagram the camping instructions for the Israelites. But when you read carefully in chapter 2, as we've already said, you find it was a traveling instruction as well. And the Judah group went first, and the Reuben group went second. And I haven't put a separate number. But when they traveled, the tent of meeting always went in the middle. So the whole of the Levites carrying the tent of meeting went in the middle, and then the third group, Ephraimites, and then the fourth group, the Danites. So that whether they were static, setting up camp, or whether they were traveling, the tent of meeting was always right in the middle. What's that telling you? God was central. God was central. And you know, that's such an important lesson. See, I don't know what your day looks like. I don't know what your week looks like. But you know, if you're a believer, God needs to be at the center. He is at the center. We need to recognize he's at the center. He's at the center of tomorrow. It isn't the agenda being set by your colleagues or by your boss or... You need the Lord at the center. And we as a church, we're traveling together. And you see, at the center is not AD. At the center is not anything that we do. At the center is God. And he needs to be at the center of each time we meet, of each home, of each one-to-one, of each meeting of WOW, of the toddler group on Thursday. Each prayer time, each Sunday service, the Lord at the center. God is central. And secondly, God is speaking. You see, in Hebrew, the very first word in Numbers is not actually the Lord. It's, and he spoke, except the and is just one letter. It's combined into the word. He spoke, and he spoke. And the Lord spoke to Moses, will you notice, in the tent of meeting. So the tent of meeting was not just a place of sacrifice, it was a place of communication. And you see, we're told in the very first word of Numbers that God is a speaking God. All over India, there are idols. All over India, there are gods. And they're all silent. The living God is a speaking God. And in the first four chapters here in Numbers, the phrase "the Lord spoke" or "said" or "commanded" comes 26 times. So just look at the first verse of each of these chapters. Verse 1, "the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting." Chapter 2, verse 1, "the Lord said to Moses and Aaron." Chapter 3, verse 1, this is the account of the family of Aaron and Moses at the time the Lord talked with Moses on Mount Sinai. Chapter 4, verse 1, "the Lord said to Moses." And you could go on. Chapter 5, verse 1, "the Lord said to Moses." Chapter 6, verse 1, "the Lord said to Moses." This phrase is an absolute, in fact, it's one of the Hebrews' names for the whole book of Numbers. It's to do with this notion of God speaking. God is a speaking God. Everything here in these first four chapters is initiated by his command. Now, what do we have on our order of service? Just look at the order of the song sheet. And just look at the front and the bottom. Somebody read it out nice and loud. What's it say? Oh, be bold, be strong. On the front. And shape. Now, that's a great strap line. Do you know, if Moses was here, he'd recognize that. He'd say, oh, wow, that's what I did. That's exactly what I did. And you see, this isn't the story of Moses' wonderful idea that he set out to accomplish. It's about what the Lord said to Moses and what Moses did. God is central, God is speaking, and God is holy. You see, the idea of God is present is really rather cheerful, isn't it? So it's a wonderful thought. But did you notice it's pretty dangerous having God at the center? Look again at chapter 1, verse 51. It says that the Levites are to do all the setting up and taking down. And then it says, anyone else who goes near it shall be put to death. Verse 53, the Levites, however, to set up their tents round the tabernacle of the testimony so that wrath will not fall on the Israelite community, so that only those who were authorized and set apart for service went there, so that nobody would wander into the tent of meeting and discover that they were not where they ought to be, that God is holy. Do you remember when Moses first met the Lord? Burning bush. Don't come any nearer. Take your shoes off. The very ground you're standing on is holy. Look in chapter 3, verse 10. Chapter 3, verse 10. Appoint Aaron and his sons to serve as priests. Anyone else who approaches the sanctuary must be put to death. Chapter 3, verse 38. Moses and Aaron and his sons were to camp to the east of the tabernacle towards the sunrise in the front of the tent of meeting. They were responsible for the care of the sanctuary on behalf of the Israelites. Anyone else who approached the sanctuary must be put to death. See, God's holy. God's truly scary. In one sense, it's absolutely right to be frightened of God. Look in chapter 3, verse 4. It's not theory. You see, in verse 2, we discover, well, we already knew, that Aaron had four sons. And verse 4 reminds us that Nadab and Abihu fell dead before the Lord when they made an offering with unauthorized fire before him in the desert of Sinai. They presumed that because they were priests, they could slightly do their own thing. It wasn't a big deal, was it? Except God thought it was a big deal. And then look in chapter 4 at the carrying of, we read part of it, the instructions about when the tabernacle was moved. Now, one group of the Levites was doing, carrying the, all the posts and the items that, the ropes that held up all the structure. Another group were carrying all the curtains. But the Kohathites, their job was to carry the most holy things. The ark itself. The special table of the presence. The altars. And actually, if you read chapter 4, verse 4 onwards, it says this is the work of the Kohathites, the care of the most holy things. Verse 5, when the camp is to move, Aaron and his sons are to go in and take down everything. And there's a whole set of instructions that Johnny read to us about how Aaron and his sons were to cover everything. And only then, verse 15, after Aaron and his sons have finished covering the holy furnishings and all the holy articles, and when the camp is ready to move, the Kohathites are to come to do the carrying. But they must not touch the holy things or they will die. So that all the holy things were wrapped up by the priests. And then in verse 20, it says, the Kohathites must not go in to look at the holy things, even for a moment, or they will die. You see, that there is a special significance. They are handling things too holy. Do you realize God's too holy for us? I mean, he's not just holy, he's too holy. You see, we've so reduced God. Our society, I mean, nothing in our society is going to teach us about this stuff. Nothing in our society is teaching us by the holiness of God. We've got a little God who's a friendly chap in the corner, and it's much to be regretted he doesn't do some of the things that I would like him to do. As though God ought to be at our beck and call. As though the whole universe revolved around us. It doesn't, it revolves around him. And he is holy. That's what it means for God to be present. And you know, we have a wonderful name as a church, don't we? Emmanuel. It's a beautiful name. It's a name of Jesus, isn't it? Emmanuel means God with us. But you know, it also should be a name that gives us a sense of awe. Causes us to catch our breath. The living God is present this evening. You see, and Christ, Emmanuel, the baby in the manger. Our society doesn't mind a baby in a manger as long as we leave him there. But he will not be left there. Revelation 19, you meet him again. And his eyes are like blazing fire. And on his head are many crowns. And he treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. And on his robe, on his thigh, he has this name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he's present amongst us. And we need to understand that the Lord is beautifully gracious and awesomely holy at the same time. And his awesome holiness should cause us to run earnestly to Jesus. Because he is the only one who can make it possible for us to stand in God's presence and live. See, how can we stand in God's presence and live? Unless Jesus has shed his blood for us. And his nail-pierced hands embrace us. God is here. God is present. Third thing. So we've seen the purpose of God, the presence of God. Thirdly, we see the provisions of God. Now this chapter describes four censuses. Chapter 1, verse 2, of all Israelite males over 20 except the Israelites. They're listed by name. We don't have the list of names, probably just as well, but we have the numbers. Can you imagine a list of, you know, if you think the Pentateuch is a bit long, imagine having 603,550 names. Well, that's what they did have, actually. Well, that was the result. In chapter 3, verse 15, Moses was meant to count all the Levite males a month old upwards. The result, verse 39, was 22,000. And the significance of counting the Levite males was that the next thing in chapter 3, verse 40, was to count all the Israelite males a month over, and the result was almost the same, but not quite, 22,273. And the point was this. When God in Egypt had struck down the firstborn of the Egyptians, he spared the Israelites. And he said that the Israelite firstborn belonged to him. And Exodus and Numbers explains that God had set apart the firstborn for himself. They belonged to the Lord. You had to redeem animals who were firstborn. You also had to redeem your children. That's what Mary and Joseph were taking Jesus to the temple to do. You had to redeem them because they actually belonged to the Lord. But the Levites represented the firstborn by being given over to the service of God. So in a way, they fulfilled the service on behalf of the firstborn. But there were 273 more of the firstborn Israelites than there were Levites, and they were redeemed, chapter 3, verse 49, by special payment. And the final census is in chapter 4, verse 2, all Levite males between 30 to 50, and the result in chapter 4, verse 48, was 8,580. Enough men of physical strength to carry all the parts of the tent of meeting. Now, Moses, can you just have some sympathy for Moses? Moses is commanded to count four times over. And the total population is not given here as a figure, but it is usually estimated at about 2 million people. So he is counting amongst 2 million people, various different categories, and in different tribes. And how on earth do you start counting everybody between 30 or 50, or everybody 2 months old or more, or everybody but not the Levites who are over 20 or more? And how do you manage 2 million people? I mean, how do you set up camp? And how do you decide to move on? And can you imagine, some of us in our families know that, we're going to go out, and you spend about amazing length of time trying to get your family together to go out. And, something happens and somebody cries and somebody needs a nappy change or whatever it is. And it takes forever. Imagine you had 2 million. See, how on earth are you going to get all those moving out at the same time, going in the right direction? You see, the job that God gave Moses was just, wow, too big. I wonder if you've ever felt that. And what God's called you to do is just too difficult. Well, I suspect we will all feel that from time to time. Well, let what God showed Moses encourage you. You see, actually, God knows what we can handle. And he helps Moses in very specific ways. Firstly, he gives people to help. See, actually, although the command is to Moses, just have a look in chapter 1, verse 2. The Lord spoke to Moses, verse 1. This is what he said. Verse 2, take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name one by one. Okay, you got a big job, Moses. You can imagine Moses saying, how on earth do I do that? Well, hang about. Verse 3, you and Aaron. So all of a sudden, there are two of them. Are to number by their divisions all the men in Israel, so on. So you've got two men doing the job. Well, that's better than one, but it's still too much. Then you look in verse 4. One man from each tribe, each head of the family, is to help you. Ah, so it's not just Moses by himself and Aaron by themselves. They have representatives of each tribe. Which are the men? Well, God knows which men they are, and in fact, he names them. So here is Elizur, son of Shedur, and here's Shemuel, I won't try anymore, son of, anyway, they, whatever their names, Nathaniel, incidentally, comes in the middle of that, at least looks like Nathaniel. I'm sure it's the same name. But however strange most of these names seem to us, the wonderful thing for Moses, it must have been music to his ears. He didn't have to think, now, who shall I appoint for that? God told him. God had the names of the people already ready. He told him, go and appoint them. So, look in verse 16. These were the men appointed from the community, the leaders of their ancestral tribes, Verse 17, Moses and Aaron took these men whose names had been given them, and they called everybody together. But do you see the principle? That actually God had anticipated the need, and the tasks were delegated. And lots of people were involved in this counting. Chapter 1, verse 18, in the NIV says, halfway through, the people indicated their ancestry by their clans and families. In the ESV, it says they registered themselves, which is to say everybody played a part to make it all possible. And if when we look at Aaron, chapter 3 and 4, he was the high priest, but he wasn't alone. Chapter 3, at the beginning of chapter 3, we read of his sons, and the two remaining sons are assisting him. But it's not just the two remaining sons. Look in verse 5 of chapter 3. Bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron the priest to assist him. You see, Aaron's job was not just on his own shoulders. He had the help of his son. He didn't just have the help of his sons. He had the whole tribe of Levi. And his sons have, you know, chapter 4, 16, Eleazar looks after one section, and Ithamar in chapter, verse 28 and 33, he has other sections. But you see the principle that God gives us to serve alongside each other. And that the special burdens and responsibilities of leadership are always undertaken and intended to be undertaken with the willing support and service of others. So the church is not run by one man or two men or five men. It is something we are all participating in. When Paul served, it's interesting, you know, you look at the stories in Acts. Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Silas, Paul and Timothy, Paul and Titus. Did you notice, beginning of 2 Thessalonians, who is the letter from? Paul, Timothy, and Silas, three of them. That's typical Paul, actually. He comments in Athens that he was by himself. He obviously didn't particularly enjoy it. He didn't stop him serving the Lord there. But you see, his notion was that he wanted to serve God with others. And he uses the wonderful image that God gave him to use, that Jesus used, the image of the church as a body. And you know, your hand has a part, and your feet has a part, and your ear has a part, and they're not the same parts, but goodness me, you'd be in some problem tonight if you didn't have any ears. Or at least you wouldn't be benefiting, hopefully, as you are, if you couldn't hear. So God means us together to do what none of us could do by ourselves. And that's how the church works. So Ephesians 4 verse 16 talks about Christ as the head, and from him the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows, and extraordinary phrase, builds itself up in love as each part does its work. Builds itself up in love. It's a bit like the Israelites counting themselves, registering themselves. That's the only way that churches can work. And that's how we need to be in Emmanuel. But it's not only people. God gives very practical instructions, doesn't he? I mean, just go to chapter 2 and look at your diagram on the back again. You see, this business of where they camped. 2 million people, you know, just setting up camp as you fancy, would have been a complete chaos. And talk about Piccadilly Circus, it would have been a nightmare. But you see, God gave a clear pattern of how they were to organize themselves. And look in verse 2, when it says, the Israelites had a camp around the tent of meeting, some distance from it, each man under his standard with the banners of his family. Now, I don't quite know how that worked. But it seems as though each tribe had a standard. You see, because it says in verse 3, the people of Judah, the camp of Judah, to camp under their standard. And each family had banners. So that when you were wandering around, you know, thinking, now where on earth should I be going? Ah, that's my tribal standard. That's my family banner. Sorry, other way around. But you see, how practical that is. How just simple and down to earth God is. And what chaos would have ensued if they'd all decided they would march off at the same time? And chapter 2, this order, why I've listed it, 1, 2, with the tent of meeting being carried, then 3, 4. That just meant that when they set out, they had a pattern to follow. You see, God does detail and God does practicality. He knows what you need tomorrow. And he knows how to deliver what you need tomorrow. And the Bible is full of very practical instructions how to live as believers, how to live in church life, how to live in family life, how to live as Paul did, as a single person, how to live in society. The epistles have the ethical, often ethical instructions at the end, and they are practical instructions how we should operate, and what grief we spare ourselves if we simply obey what God has said. So God still provides people, and God still gives us his words of practical wisdom. So we see these different features of these chapters: the purpose of God, the presence of God, and the provision of God. There's one final thing to say, the challenge to us. Just look in chapter 1, and the tie-up between chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, and chapter 1, verses 17 and 18. Let me just read it, 1 and 2, just listen carefully. The Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. He said, take a census. Okay, that's the beginning. Then go to verse 17. Moses and Aaron took those men whose names had been given, and they called together the whole community. They called the whole community together on the first day of the second month. But what do you notice? Verse 1 and verse 18. Same day. Isn't that interesting? Same day. Isn't that significant? Moses and Aaron didn't sort of hang about for a week or two to work out how this might all function properly. They set to. They rushed out of that tent, and they were sending instructions to those men who were called together, and they sent out instructions to everybody to meet together, and the very same day, they went for it. And don't you think that was pleasing to God? When we see what Scripture says, I mean, how long are we going to wait to obey? How long are we going to wait to be self-controlled? How long are we going to wait to love people? How long are we going to wait to forgive? How long are we going to wait to be patient? Well, we need to go to it. And just look at the last verse. We looked at the first verse of each chapter, and they all are connected. Look at the last verse of each chapter, and they're all connected. Now, I know that chapter divisions are not inspired, but the medieval monk who divided up the chapters of the Bible did a tremendous service to the Christian church and the ancient Israelites as well. Just have a look at the last verse of each chapter. Chapter 1, verse 54. The Israelites did all this just as the Lord had commanded Moses. End of chapter 2. So the Israelites did everything the Lord commanded Moses. Look at the end of chapter 3. Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and his sons as he was commanded by the word of the Lord. Look at the end of chapter 4, the last verse. At the Lord's command through Moses, each was assigned his work and told what to do. Thus they were counted as the Lord commanded Moses. Do you see? Commanded, 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 obeyed, obeyed, obeyed. You get it? They obeyed. And you see, it's a wonderful beginning. But it's also a poignant beginning, because in the book of Numbers, we discover that the entire generation of Israelites who came out of Egypt died in the desert. Apart from Joshua and Caleb, the entire generation. They died in the desert without ever making it to the promised land. How can that be? It wasn't actually because it was such a long journey. It didn't take 40 years. You know, it may have taken a couple of months, but it did not take 40 years to get from Sinai to Canaan. No, the trouble was they went there and they sent the spies in, and God told them to go into the land with all these men that he'd identified to be the army. And you know what happened? The spies came back and said, "Oh, they've got high, big walls. They've got great cities. They're really strong physically. I mean, they're giants. We seem like toddlers in comparison. And there are so many of them. And they're all these different, you know, they'll join together. We won't have a chance." And they talked themselves into disbelief and disobedience. And none of that generation ever went in. The journey, they never made. But their children did. Because their children, born in the desert, learnt to believe and obey. And you see, just being part of the official body of those following God is not the same thing as believing and obeying. And in Hebrews 4, which is directly refers to this passage and this whole story in Numbers, it says that the promise of entering God's rest, that was first case Canaan, but in his case he's thinking of it as a picture looking forward to heaven. Since the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. For we also have had the gospel preached to us, just as they did. That's a generation in Moses' times. But the message they heard was of no value to them, because those who heard it did not combine it with faith. In other words, they simply didn't believe God when it actually came to it. Verse 11, let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. You see, will we believe God and obey him is the great question for all who say they're followers of Jesus. Now, please God, by God's grace, there are many, many hundreds of thousands who have and will continue to believe and obey Jesus. Let's just make sure that we're among them. Remember the old children's chorus? Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey.